But here's what happened, right? The first time you get, and think about this, anytime you've had a water fight or like something like this, there's a part of you that is trying to stay clean and dry, you know? So like the milk, chocolate milk is coming and you're ducking and then here comes another one and it hits you. And I can remember this experience of getting hit with chocolate milk and that feeling of discomfort, right? And with that first chocolate milk, there's a kind of agitation that comes up. There's a like an irritability. And then the second chocolate milk comes. And that may increase, you know? And then all of a sudden you have mashed potatoes in the hair, you know? At some point there is a breaking. And you've all had this. Where you're just like, well, hell, I'm, you know, I got like chocolate mashed potatoes all over. I might as well like get dirty. You know, and it's interesting that I was thinking about this in relation to Jesus making the lives of those around him so uncomfortable. And I think it's a good spiritual teacher that is going to constantly push and push and push you until you get to that place of surrender. Because something beautiful happens when you finally surrender. Like you're having a water balloon fight, you know, and finally you're trying to stay dry, and finally there's a point where you realize you're wet. And then you just surrender. And there's a movement, right, from the small mind to the big mind. There's a movement from the narrow mind to the expansive mind. And there's a playfulness that arises. There is a kind of delight. And I think almost a type of possibility comes back into the mind. Because at first, it's really that preservation mind. How can I preserve myself from not being sticky? You know, we were just on the plane yesterday, and I put chocolate in my pocket. And I forgot, and we had a long car ride and talking with friends, and I got very, like, warm physically, you know. And then all of a sudden, I put my hand, and it completely melted, you know. And it's just, but it was at such a state where it was just irritable. You know, it wasn't like, I was just on that edge where I was just irritable for the rest of the flight because I had like, you know, I didn't have clothes with me because they were underneath the plane. So I had to have like sticky chocolate pockets for, you know, 7 hours of travel. And the spiritual teachers are constantly like giving us icky chocolate pockets, you know? And just like, just when we think like, you know, we're trying to push them away and then they just give us another one and another one. And just think about the times in your life when you've gotten knocked on the head with chocolate milk. And then that place where you can finally surrender. So if this hypothesis is true, then much of the spiritual life is not about trying to create more comfort for yourselves, but trying to move yourself into a state of voluntary discomfort so that your heart can expand to be able to incorporate other people. You know, Tucson's a big bike culture, and you see these bumper stickers, which I think are so great. They say, God grant me the courage to sell my car. You know? And that's the first step, right? It's not that, like, the first step towards moving into the spiritual life is just to have that feeling of, God grant me the courage to become more comfortable with discomfort. A car is a comfortable thing. It's more comfortable than a bicycle, especially when the wind kicks up and the heat kicks up, you know. So that God grant me the courage to sell my car, there's some wisdom in that, in knowing that bicycling gives me a kind of pleasure that's not easily apparent. That the car, although it's more comfortable, there's a kind of numbness that can settle in. When I ride my bike to work, I'm a lot happier, I'm more alert, and I'm more uncomfortable at first. Do you know what I mean? It's just more comfortable to get into the car and to drive to work. And it creates a kind of a dullness in the mind, a kind of comfort that eventually leads me in an inability to open my heart. You know, my first teacher as a child, a beautiful man named Murray Rogers, had taken on a vow of poverty. And I think I told you this story, but when I went to go live with him, it was very difficult for me because it was very uncomfortable. And they lived in Canada at the time, and they lived off of food scraps, like from the grocery store, you know, the rotten cabbage and stuff like that. And they always kept the heat down because they didn't have the money to keep the heat going. The only room that they kept hot was the bathroom, because that's where they dried their clothes. And so I would always end up in the bathroom because it was the only time I was comfortable. And I remember one morning coming out of the bathroom, you know, they're like, they were all English. So they're like, William, you know, breakfast time. And so I come out and they start talking to me about how everything was going. Like, how is the food okay? I'm like, yeah, it's fine. They're like, is everything digestion? Is it okay? You know, I'm like, it's fine. And suddenly I realized that because I was spending so much time in the bathroom, they thought that, you know, obviously I must be having some kind of digestive problems. I said, listen, I'm just so uncomfortable. It's like the only time I can have peace of mind. And then I started watching them, and I realized that they were so utterly comfortable in their discomfort. They also didn't use the shower, even though they had a perfectly functioning hot water shower. They just bathed out of a little bucket, and each of them got one bucket a day, you know? Just total self-imposed lack of comfort. But within that, they found a total freedom. And I asked him one time, right before he died, I said, if you could have done anything differently, what would you have done? And he said, I would have given it all up sooner. He said, but I was so scared about being uncomfortable. I was so scared that that would actually, that I wouldn't be able to handle it. He said, had I known the freedom that existed in that final surrender, I would have done it so much younger. And I always think about that because I'm still not able to give that up, you know? There's still a part of me that resonates, and I know there's a truth to that, but I can't make some kind of chocolate milk leap. You know what I mean? I'm still like comfortable enough that I'm trying to like stay unsticky. It's a beautiful quote, poem by Rumi about fasting, and I find fasting is one little way that can slowly open my heart. Like, it's a little way that I can voluntarily move into a conscious uncomfortableness. But just think about it even metaphorically. He says, there's hidden sweetness in the stomach's emptiness. We are lutes, no more, no less. If the sound box is stuffed full of anything, no music. If the brain and belly are burning clean with fasting, every moment a new song comes out of the fire. If the brain and the belly are burning clean with fasting, every moment a new song comes out of the fire. The fog clears, the new energy makes you run up the steps in front of yourself. Be emptier and cry like reed instruments cry. Emptier, write secrets with the reed pen. When you're full of food and drink, Satan sits where your spirit should. An ugly metal statue in place of the Kaaba. When you fast, good friends, good habits gather like friends who want to help. Fasting is Solomon's ring. Don't give it to some illusion and lose your power. But even if you have, even if you've lost all will and control, they come back when you fast. Like soldiers appearing out of the ground, pennants flying above them. A table descends to your tents. Jesus' table. Expect to see it when you fast. This table spread with other food, better than the broth of cabbages. Every time we make effort to make ourselves comfortable, right? I think it's possible that we're limiting our ability to surrender. And I lived for a little while at the Abbey of Gethsemane, a Trappist Benedictine Cistercian monastery in Kentucky. And while I lived there, one of the brothers died. And the way they deal with death in the monastery, and think about how we deal with death in this culture. We deal with it in a way that makes everybody as comfortable as possible. Morgues are like, almost have no signage in front of them. They're like nondescript buildings set back, you know. You almost never see dead bodies. Unlike India, they actually strap the dead body to the roof of like rickshaws and stuff, and they drive it around for a while first. And then they take it to the burning ghats. I used to have to walk through the burning ghats every morning on my way to class when I lived in India. And it's like kids are playing marbles around the burning bodies and flying kites, and the relatives are hanging out talking. you know, it almost has a park-like feel, you know? But we're so crazy around death that we just hide it away. When with the Benedictines, what they do is they take the unembalmed, they legally have rights that most of us don't because of a religious law or something, I don't know how it works, grandfathered in, but they don't have to embalm bodies, and they can bury them unembalmed out without caskets, just in the bare earth. So they take the body and they put it in the middle of the cathedral where we spend all day, every day, and they just leave it there to rot for 3 days. Now, one of the brothers died while I was there, and I was one of the newer people in the monastery, so I had the little like pew thing that was right next to the body, so like is close to me in that blanket, you know, and the smell was unbelievable, you know, it was so difficult, and to watch the, you know, the blood sink out of the body and how the face changes and everything, and it's not in a casket, it's just sitting there, you know. And then the young monks are the ones that have to dig the graves, which I thought was just so mean, you know. And they have backhoes. It's not like they don't have backhoes, but they put them back there with, you know, shovels. And it takes about 3 days to dig a grave deep enough. So now why do they do that? Are they just kind of morbid people? You know, and you see this over and over in religious traditions. Or is there some type of clue there that the more we move ourselves closer to the things we think are limiting our happiness, right? For example, an acknowledgement of death. Most of us don't want to look at that. We're like, oh, you know, I would like to stay comfortable. I would like to not look at that. But is it possible that the religious traditions have some clue that the more we voluntarily move into that territory, the more our heart expands, the more we're able to maintain some glimpse of possibility, and not some false sense of preservation of what we think we have? Yeah, it's interesting because we are actually talking about becoming comfortable, but we're talking about it through a counterintuitive way. We are talking about achieving greater levels of happiness, about achieving greater levels of contentment. We're not talking about becoming morbid or becoming like suffering people and like, I'm spiritual and I'm suffering now, you know? Like, I'm Catholic and I'm suffering now and I'm Buddhist and all life is suffering, you know? Christ said, very narrow is the gate which leads to everlasting life, and wide open is the gate to lead to death and destruction. And, you know, it would seem like a very narrow gate would be to disguise it under the thing that you most want to avoid. You know, for example, death, things that make you slightly uncomfortable. That might be a, you know, might be one kind of narrow gate that then opens up the heart.